Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Trump administration is sending federal troops to Chicago in response to increasing gun violence, but there is some skepticism.
We need to make these moments of grief and anguish a thing of the past. There have to be safe places.
Today on The Takeaway for Thursday, July 23rd, we're talking about the Trump administration's plans to deploy agents to cities around the country. Also on the show, a bill to curb military-grade equipment from being sent to local law enforcement gets killed in the Senate.
Police are using this gear in everyday situations. Oftentimes, once they have it, they will use it in serving warrants and making standard arrests. And that is quite frightening.
And a look at BORTAC, the elite unit of the Border Patrol we've seen on the ground in Portland. But first... At least 15 people were shot outside a funeral home in Chicago's Auburn-Gresham neighborhood on Tuesday night, adding to the drastic increase in homicides and shootings across that city over the past year. In response to the recent gun violence, the Trump administration said it would plan to send 150 federal agents to Chicago this week, and that would echo recent deployments of federal law enforcement to cities including Portland, Oregon, where federal agents have reportedly used unmarked cars to arrest and detain protesters. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot said on Wednesday that her city would collaborate with federal law enforcement, but she also expressed skepticism about President Trump's approach.
Unfortunately, we can't put anything past the Trump administration. I'm hopeful that they will not be foolish enough to bring that kind of nonsense to Chicago, but I'm also not naive, and we're going to be diligent, and we're going to be ready, and if we need to stop them, we are going to.
We're going to be talking more about the Trump administration's deployment of federal law enforcement agents later in the show. In the meantime, the city's residents are trying to confront the threats of both gun violence and the coronavirus. And that's where we start today on The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Joining me now is Natalie Moore, reporter for Race, Class, and Communities at WBEZ in Chicago. Natalie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also is with us is Demetrius Watley, a site director for Cure Violence Chicago, a community-based violence prevention organization. Demetrius, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So, Demetrius, let's start with you. What do you see that are some of the factors driving the violence in Chicago right now?
Well, that's a few things that's driving it. I know one thing for sure is that a lot of the clubs and things are closing early, and a lot of parks are closing early, which are forcing a lot of individuals to come to these neighborhood blocks and gather 50 to 100 people at one time. And that's prime idea for a guy who's into it with somebody. If they see their target right there, they just shoot down the block and figure they'll hit somebody. Usually when you're in these clubs, the clubs don't close till 2 a.m. So after that, you usually go home or whatever. But now they just congregate on these blocks throughout the communities in Chicago, and it's sad.
And Demetrius, you're talking mostly about closures or early closures because of the coronavirus pandemic. Is that right?
Correct. Yes, correct.
And Natalie, you know, there's a lot of talk about when shootings and gun violence in particular happen in communities of color about what those shootings, what's prompting a lot of that. You wrote on Twitter, and I'm quoting here, that violence is the symptom of other inequities. Tell us what you meant by that.
If you look at the communities and the neighborhoods that have the most gun violence, it's going to be a handful of places. And these are the places that are the most racially and economically segregated. You see a lot of boarded up buildings. You see a lot of disinvestment. You don't see the same type of thriving Chicago that you see in other type of neighborhoods. And until segregation, disinvestment, economic development, and also mental health are addressed, we're going to keep seeing the same things over and over again.
Demetrius, you work on a violence prevention program in Chicago, and you work something that was called a violence interrupter. What does that mean? What was the type of work that you're doing?
So one thing about the violence interrupters, they work directly in the community, directly in the hot spots. What I mean by hot spots, areas where there's known shootings at, where shootings will occur. And what we do is we're there for 6 to 8 hours a day because we're from that community that we work in. So we know the individuals in the community, we know the young men and women in the community, the key players, So we're able to listen to everything that's going on and diffuse any situation that may arise, mediate conflicts when they come up, and basically try to change the mindset that's out here in the street committing these acts of gun violence. So we're very hands-on.
It's very hands-on. And I'm wondering, you know, a lot of this is, you mentioned that if someone sees someone that they don't like, is a lot of the violence that we're seeing right now connected to gang activity or not?
Well, some of the stuff is historical. And a lot of it is just really, a lot of guys doing clout chasing. You know, it's monkey see, monkey do thing right now. We ask some of these guys, what are you fighting for? They can't give you a clear answer. Hmm. They just knew they grew up on this block, and this block always hated the other block. So they feel that they have to continue with the same nonsense. And we've been trying to change their whole mindset about this gun violence all around the board. And those young guys, they listen. It's just that when you're not able to be out there 24 hours a day with them, then that's when the problems occur.
And Natalie, I'm wondering if your reporting can tell us anything about how effective some of these prevention efforts have been by community organizations in Chicago. I mean, I know Demetrius and other folks are out there trying to do their best, but how has that been working?
That's a really good question, because I think that there's also a myth that Black people don't care about interracial violence in their communities. When tragedies like this happen, with the shooting this week, there becomes this onslaught of, oh, they only care about police killings. They don't care about the people being killed in their own community. And that's just simply not true. The type of work that I see is hyper-local, from block club presidents to interrupters works to, you know, there's even a mom who set up a corner in the Inglewood neighborhood, you know, every day in the summer. There are social service organizations, community-based organizations. So there is efficacy that's going on in these communities, but they can't do it alone. You may see some dents. You may see some healing that goes on, and people maybe not retaliating or picking up a gun or giving youth options for an alternative. But again, I can't emphasize enough that, you know, those are temporary, those are band-aid approaches, and they're very important. I'm not undermining them. But
I want to talk a little bit about where we stand in this moment today. And I would like to ask both of you this question, because there are two polar opposite, I think, ideas that are floating around, or even actions, should I say, going beyond ideas. Protesters, as we've seen in the uprising for racial justice across the nation this summer, one of the biggest demands has been to defund the police, which means essentially siphoning off a significant portion of police budgets to go to community organizations. On the other side of that spectrum, you have the Trump administration saying cities are out of control. We're sending in federal law enforcement agents, as we are going to see in Chicago. And it feels like what's happening here is that Chicagoans in particular, and other folks who are experiencing violence on a daily basis, gun violence, are caught in the middle of these two opposing forces. One which is saying defund the police, the other which is saying, you know, we're going to flood the zone with high elite, you know, tactical officers. So, Natalie, what's your thought on that? And Demetrius, I'd love to hear from you as well.
You know, I do think that Black people in Black neighborhoods have a complicated relationship with the police. In many ways, they feel under-policed, but also over-policed. But I think that the bottom line, where there is some agreement here, is that we can't police our way out of these issues, and that the police are being asked to do too much. And there are also questions about what are we asking the police to do that don't have anything to do with crime, such as writing parking tickets. You know, mental health is a huge issue. And a lot of times when people feel like they don't have anyone to call. And so when you have police officers who have no training in mental health come out to a situation, does that make the situation worse? So what are alternatives? So I think that these are good conversations to continue to have, but you're going to have people say, you know, there were police officers, you know, in the communities, they can't stop the crime from happening. there has to be something deeper to change in the communities, and looking beyond, we can't look at the police as the only source to do that.
Demetrius, what's your organization's relationship like with the Chicago Police Department? And tell us about what that's like. And I'm curious also to know your thoughts about where we find ourselves in this moment. But how does the organization deal with the Chicago PD?
Well, the way we deal with the Chicago Police, as far as my team that's on the ground, they doesn't communicate with the police at all as far as interaction with them because of credibility issues. The same way with a lawyer and his client, that's the same way we approach our participants. So it's a trust issue and a credibility with our participant that we service. But on a higher level, they communicate with law enforcement throughout the city of Chicago. And also, I truly believe that there should be more funding going towards these community-based organizations. As far as what we do, we're able to get places where the police can't get. We're able to touch the community where police can't touch. We're able to talk to the young guys in the street because they trust us because we come from that same community, and they know we have their best interests at heart. We're not trying to send them to jail, or we don't want to see them killed. So they listen to us. So I think we need more focus on those community-based organizations, those who have hands-on, those who can really reach these kids, because like the sister said, our people have a lot of trust issues with CPD. I mean, they grew up with our trust issues, so it's been taught to them about don't trust the police. So guys like us and women like us who's out there in the street, we're able to deal with these situations way better than the police can. And we've been kind of effective in the work that we do.
Natalie, Mayor Lightfoot has said that she is going to allow, at least temporarily, for the Trump administration to send additional federal law enforcement troops to the city. She since said that she would obviously keep an eye on that after receiving some criticism. So she walked that back a little bit. But where do things stand right now? And how is the community looking at Mayor Lightfoot in light of the recent outburst that we've seen in Portland, for example?
Mayor Lightfoot has not minced words in the past to President Trump. And as many listeners might have heard, the president often uses Chicago as a punching bag in his speeches with dog whistles about race, as well as attacking the city on Twitter. So I think that it's really, does he have any credibility? Someone who hasn't shown any real empathy or understanding of Chicago's issues and has turned it into a partisan issue. With the mayor saying, we'll monitor, you know, I also think that there will be people in the communities who will be monitoring and making sure or alerting folks if they start seeing, you know, agents come out into communities and start doing arrests. I think that there will be significant resistance here in Chicago.
Well, we'll be paying close attention. Natalie Moore is a reporter for WBEZ, and Demetrius Watley is site director for Cure Violence Chicago. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
The demilitarization of the police is one of the many reforms racial justice protesters have been calling for over the last couple of months. On Tuesday, the Senate rejected a bipartisan proposal attached to the annual defense bill that would have stopped the Pentagon from supplying some surplus military equipment to police departments. Since the 1990s, a Defense Department program known as 1033 has supplied more than 8,000 local police agencies with more than $7 billion worth of surplus military equipment. That was part of the National Defense Authorization Act. Much of that equipment, like armored vehicles, riot gear, and tear gas, have been used by local police at many of the racial justice protests across the country. While the Senate rejected the broader proposal, they did reintroduce limitations to 1033 that the Obama administration made in 2014 after police in Ferguson used military equipment during the protests sparked by the police killing of Michael Brown. President Trump had rolled back these changes when he got into office. Here to talk about the militarization of the police and where the 1033 program stands is Stuart Schrader, a lecturer in sociology at Johns Hopkins University and the author of Badges Without Borders. Stuart, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We listed a couple of types of military equipment, but let's clarify. I mean, what are the most common types of equipment that police are using these days?
During the protests, we've seen police using everyday equipment that they might use in normal operations, obviously batons We've seen tear gas, and we've seen some very technologically sophisticated weapons like so-called sound cannons. Some of these materials are coming from surplus stocks from the Department of Defense, but many of them are not. They're just in the closets in police departments ready to be deployed as necessary.
Did police departments across the country ask for these types of equipment to be sent to them, or are they just being sent to them as surplus?
Well, I think historically, police have asked the Department of Defense for surplus. It's not a recent phenomenon, and they've often tried to make up for shortfalls in their budgets and their ability to buy the types of equipment they want or think they need by imploring the federal government to help them out. Obviously, the federal government has a lot of money and spends a lot of money on this type of material, and police have become quite adept at making these types of demands to get this surplus material from the military. And right now, anytime the police get the surplus material, they do have to make a specific request, although what they request is not always what they get.
I covered the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri after the killing of Michael Brown, Stuart, and it was the first time that I had witnessed and actually was tear gassed and saw rubber bullets and saw tanks and law enforcement agents in fatigues and flashbangs. I mean, it was, to say the least, an intense situation, I think, one that was very surprising to witness in an American city. Stuart, how has the use of military equipment by police affected policing in this country and engaging with communities that are protesting? Because that seems to be when this is really rolled out.
Well, I think the protests have highlighted the wide adoption of this material. It seems in so many cities, like, police are able to come to these protests outfitted in this military style gear, often even in camouflage body armor and on these armored trucks. But I think what the protests have shown to people, because the police have this material, is that it's not just being used in protests. The police are using this type of military gear, which of course is obtained under the premise that it might be needed in crisis or emergency situations, but police are using this gear in everyday situations. Oftentimes, once they have it, they will use it in serving warrants and making standard arrests. And that is quite frightening, and I think also raises questions for a lot of people about whether this type of material is compatible with the types of constitutional protections that most people hope police are abiding by.
Well, and it also just the tone and the environment. I mean, seeing and witnessing four or five tear gas canisters being, you know, around your car, and, you know, I'll never forget seeing people running into the McDonald's on West Florissant Avenue trying to find milk to clear their eyes. We're talking about, you know, families and young children and other folks who were out protesting. So, you know, there have been lots of concerns, obviously, about the safety, public safety, as this type of technology is deployed. And Stuart, a couple of weeks ago, I hosted a Facebook forum on the future of policing, during which we spoke to Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo. And this is what he had to say about the use of military equipment.
Because it's not about the equipment. It's about the proper use of the equipment, the circumstances, the policy and the use of the equipment, and the proper supervision, command, and control.
What do you make of that, Art Acevedo's comment there?
I think it's certainly true that a lot of the military surplus gear that gets passed on to police forces doesn't come with training in its use. But I'm skeptical that proper training or using the materials according to manufacturers' specifications is actually going to fix the problem. What we're seeing, particularly with the use of tear gas in these protests, is that it's not being used in a de-escalatory fashion. It's not being used to defend police. Oftentimes, police seem to be using it in an offensive fashion. They're using it to escalate the confrontation, and it's inciting protesters. And that's not just about the training in its proper usage. That's about the attitudes of the officers and the more broad political situation and the political mobilization that police themselves are being used in to suppress and quell dissent.
Stuart Schrader is a lecturer in sociology at Johns Hopkins University and the author of Badges Without Borders, How Global Counterinsurgency Transformed American Policing. Stuart, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Hi, I'm Helga Davis. On my show, I speak with artists and thinkers about how to uncover the extraordinary in everyday life. People like musicians Brittany Howard and Sampha, Broadway director Whitney White, scholar Noli Way Rooks, and playwright Suzanne Laurie Parks. These are fearless conversations where we don't just meet each other, we meet ourselves. Join us. Listen to Helga wherever you get podcasts.
They come out here and they declare riot because one person throws a water bottle and they start throwing tear gas at us and shooting us with rubber bullets and pepper bombs.
Defend our democracy and tell the feds to go home because they don't belong here.
I'm Tanzina Vega. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Federal officials have continued to meet the ongoing protest movement in Portland, Oregon with force. Heavily armed officers in fatigues have been recorded beating and arresting protesters, and even Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler was reportedly tear gassed while on the scene of the uprising last night. The officers are members of an elite Border Patrol unit called BORTAC, the Border Patrol Tactical Unit. And as the Trump administration ramps up its efforts to deploy federal agents to cities experiencing increases in gun violence, there's growing concern among local leaders about these agents' use of force and the constitutionality of those deployments. I'm now joined by Todd Miller, a journalist and the author of Empire of Borders and Border Patrol Nation. Todd, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Tanzina. Thank you for having me.
Who are BORTAC, Todd? What do they do and why are they in Portland?
Well, BORTAC is the Special Forces Unit of the U.S. Border Patrol. They have actually been around since the early 1980s, and they are Border Patrol agents who have been stationed on the U.S. southern border with Mexico. They were then put into this elite group, kind of a Special Forces group of the U.S. Border Patrol known as BORTAC. Their origins were to quell uprisings in immigration detention in the early 1980s, and they've been deployed in places beyond the border over many years, including the Super Bowl, for example. And so when they deployed, or learning that they were deployed in Portland was actually not a surprise at all. And the fact that they were actually going and snatching people off the streets and putting them into cars and arresting them. As Border Patrol agents, that's what they do on the U.S.-Mexico border. So it's actually a kind of translation of the interior expansion of the border to a northern city within the United States.
And just to be clear, Todd, the folks that we saw in Portland who are wearing fatigues and deploying the force that we've witnessed, those are from the BORTAC unit as part of the Border Patrol, correct?
All the reporting has said that they were BORTAC agents present in Portland. There were, in some cases, those BORTAC agents were the ones that went and grabbed people off the streets. The BORTAC deployment was a part of a larger federal deployment, part of a joint task force, and I believe that's what it's going to be going forward in the different in cities like Chicago and other cities going forward.
Border Patrol being deployed to Portland feels quite bizarre. I mean, why would this unit be deployed by federal agencies to do what it's doing right now?
Border Patrol actually operates in what is known as a 100-mile zone. The ACLU has described the 100-mile zones as a constitution-free zone. And the 100-mile zones constitute 100 miles from the U.S. border inland. So literally, Portland is within this border jurisdiction. What the Border Patrol can do in these jurisdictions is the Fourth Amendment, your right not to be searched nor seized, that gets mangled. They can question you. They can pull you out of your car without a warrant. They can go through your things.
And if you're an American citizen, Todd?
Yes, even if you're an American citizen. For example, at a checkpoint, if you go through border checkpoints, they ask you if you're a U.S. citizen. You either say yes or no. But if they see something suspicious, or according to the criteria of the agent, at the checkpoint, they can pull you over for what is called secondary inspection. And secondary inspection, then they can start, you can get interrogated. There's actually all kinds of horror stories of people being detained for hours or even, I've heard, of days.
Todd, what type of technology are BORTAC equipped with?
The most sophisticated surveillance technologies that you can imagine, going from biometrics, from digital fingerprinting to facial recognition, to the use of surveillance cameras, to the use of drone technology that can do overflights and use their cameras and use their radar systems. And they also come equipped with concussion grenades, and they're highly weaponized.
How has BORTAC grown over the past couple of presidential administrations, Todd?
Over the last 25 years, actually. In 1994, there was 4,000 Border Patrol agents. And then now there's approximately 20,000 to 21,000 agents, an unprecedented increase over many administrations. I mention it 25 years because there were significant operations during the Clinton years, even more significant operations post 9/11 with the George W. Bush years that really expanded the Border Patrol and BORTAC. BORTAC naturally has been bolstered as well. Even by the time that Donald Trump entered the White House in 2017, you know, the Border Patrol was already about 20 to 21,000. They had a budget of about $20 billion, annual budget of $20 billion. And there had been a significant growth pattern leading up to this moment in which then the Trump administration has ratcheted this up in ways that were probably previously unimaginable, but it has expanded significantly. So that's another really interesting lens to look at these, how this Border Patrol unit is ending up in all these different cities that one would not normally think as a border.
Todd, on Tuesday, BuzzFeed published a piece that said that other officials within the Department of Homeland Security are concerned that the deployment of BORTAC and other forces similar to in Portland and other cities might hurt the agency's reputation.
I can't imagine DHS has a good reputation to begin with. In fact, we know that they really do not, especially after the last 3 or 4 years and hearing about forcible separations of families at the border and you know, detention camps, children being detained. It's kind of a surprising comment to say that. Obviously, it's interesting in terms of conscience, you know, that there's a contingent within DHS that are seeing sorts of deployments and thinking, wow, you know, there's a moment of reflection within the ranks, which is very, very interesting. But to have the premise that it's based upon a good reputation from before to a bad reputation because of this is, I have a little bit of trouble totally buying that, just based on, you know, the history of DHS, what they have been doing over the years, and so for a reputation improvement, it seems like something else would have, you know, that they would have to have significant policy changes, or there had to have to be something significant to happen for such a dynamic or reputation change to occur.
Todd Miller is a journalist and the author of Empire of Borders and Border Patrol Nation. Todd, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
The journalism industry continues to reckon with its legacy of systemic racism. Earlier this week, Latino journalists at the Los Angeles Times sent an open letter to leadership demanding better newsroom representation. Nearly half of the residents in the Los Angeles region are Latino, but only 13% of the Los Angeles Times newsroom is also Latino. The letter by the LA Times journalists comes just weeks after their Black colleagues also called for similar change at the paper. And the letter also comes at a time when many of the media narratives about Latinos in the United States often focus solely on immigration and not on the broader issues like police brutality and income inequality. I'm joined now by one of the journalists behind the efforts to diversify the LA Times newsroom, Esmeralda Bermudez, a staff writer at the Times focusing on the lives of Latinos. Esmeralda, thanks for joining us.
Gracias for having me. Thank you so much.
Also with us is Graciela Mochovsky, the director of the Spanish Language Journalism Program at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism and my alma mater. Graciela, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Esmeralda, tell us why you and your colleagues decided to write the letter beyond the numbers that we just cited at the top.
God, so many reasons. I think, you know, it's important to let you and your audience know that this week was historic for Latinos at the LA Times. It's really the largest, most significant public action we've taken in 139 years since the paper was established. We had more than 80 Latinos in the newsroom come out and say that the LA Times must do better. And here's a list of demands to hold you accountable and also to collaborate with you. And the reason we did it really is because LA's, you know, this huge complex, beautiful place, and it's also a place, as you mentioned, that's half Latino, and writing thoroughly and responsibly about Latinos and having a staff that's representative of our newsroom, it's not only a moral issue, it's about accurate journalism, and it's honestly what makes most financial sense. And, you know, I think any salesman coming to L.A. to sell, whether it's car insurance or laundry detergent, would know that they have to cater to the Latino market, that they will not survive without Latinos. And we have to commit to doing the same at our papers as storytellers and watchdogs. It's the only way we're going to succeed.
What has management responded to the letter yet? I know it got a lot of traction on social media with the hashtag that you guys created, SoyLAT. But what has management said so far?
We actually had four different hashtags trending throughout California and Los Angeles all day. Our management has offered a, you know, wonderful response. We're going to be meeting with them actually later today, and go you know, one by one on our demands. And so we're really looking forward to them listening with intent, and, you know, in good faith, really taking immediate action on a number of these items, because it's a critical mission, you know, all around. Over the decades, you know, at our paper and so many newsrooms, really, Latinos have, you know, they've won the Pulitzers, they've done the investigative work, they've covered the fires, the plane crashes, the mass shootings. And we regularly here at our paper write pieces that have national impact. And I think the thing is, our excellence should not be an exception. It really needs to be nurtured and trusted and promoted. And this is kind of our hopefully a new beginning for us in starting that conversation.
Graciela, when you hear about these letters that have been taken, particularly for the first time in the LA Times newsroom among Latinos, we should note that the LA Times investigative staff has zero Latinos on its team right now. Why is it so critical, Graciela, that these newsrooms reflect the wider community, not just in a city like Los Angeles, but cities across the country?
Well, because it has been proven again and again that if newsrooms are full of people who are not in contact with the communities they write or they talk about, they don't cover them well. They don't understand their concerns, their lives. You know, historically, it has been understood the opposite way within newsrooms, that if you are a person of color, you're biased to cover communities of color. And so the consequences of that has been that the white male perspective, which is the majority even today in newsrooms, you know, is made out of men who are white. So that perspective was considered the universal non-biased perspective. And it has been proven again and again that that perspective is very biased and limited. I think it also has to do with an issue of trust. You know, trust in media in this country is very low in the world, but in this country as well. And there's enough data showing that, in particularly among communities of color, local mainstream media is not trusted, and is not trusted because they've seen how they've been portrayed by, you know, the stereotyping and or the lack of understanding that with which they've been covered for a very long time. So I think this is the change that is being requested.
We're now also joined by Francis Negron Muntaner, a media scholar and professor at Columbia University. Francis, your department at Columbia studies Latino media in particular and Latino media habits. What do we know about how Latinos are consuming media today and what this call for diversity for more Latinos at the LA Times could possibly mean?
Well, our studies demonstrate that Latinos definitely want to see a much broader range of representation, that they're very aware of the arc and the relationship between stereotyping and media company bottom line. And one of the fascinating things about this problematic is that in our studies, I've suggested that media companies are aware that if they were more diverse, both at the level of decision making and storytelling, and or in the case of newsroom coverage, they would actually make more money. They would actually reach more people. But they don't do it to a large extent, because what's on the table really is the power to not only frame the story, but also to influence society to reproduce the conditions of power that they already enjoy and the perspectives that they uphold. So I just wanted to call attention to that, because often the conversation is about diversity, inclusion, or climate in institutions. But I think it's important to say that the bottom line of this conversation is power.
Francis, I want to play you a clip from an interview I did with Julian Castro just a couple weeks ago.
If it has to do with immigration, you know, they're all right there. You know, you're getting a lot of coverage. Hey, you know, let's figure out what Latinos have to say about this. But if it deals with something else, whether it's police violence or jobs in the economy or healthcare or technology or you name it, well, that's not really, that's not a Latino issue. They're not going to focus oftentimes on that aspect of that issue with regard to Latinos.
Francis, that's Julian Castro was referring there to media coverage and the narratives that we hear. I'd love to hear your thoughts on his statement right there.
Well, that's absolutely borne by my work. We found repeatedly that in news coverage, in broadcasts, over 62% of stories are often about immigration, crime, not being the victim of police brutality, but being criminals or targeted as criminals. Disasters, that's actually a third major thematic usually associated with the U.S. territories like Puerto Rico or nations in Latin America. And often those stories about disaster, when they're political disasters, are still covered through what we could call a Cold War lens. So in that sense, you're threatening as criminal, illegal or undocumented immigrant or a communist, you know. So yes, absolutely. That's the lens. And what's interesting about that in the long arc of the studies that we have done is that these narratives of what we could call danger at the border have been present in cinema since the invention of motion pictures. And what I found interesting is that that danger at the border thematic that was so crucial to the success of Hollywood in the silent era, it was actually fueling profits for the studios, now lives pretty comfortably in the newsrooms. It's one of the places where that narrative that there's a threat at the border that's going to overwhelm the U.S. in some disastrous way gets continuously reproduced.
Esmeralda, you are actually doing the work. You're reporting in Los Angeles. When you hear Julian Castro say this, I mean, you're the person that's coming up with ideas, that's going out into the field and actually doing the reporting. Have you found that as a challenge to get past narratives that are limited to immigration? Not to suggest that those stories are not important, but that there needs to be a broader lens when covering Latinos in this country.
Every day. I've been doing this work for about 12 years now at the LA Times, and it's the kind of work that's more nuanced, more layers. It means sitting in Latinos' living rooms on their couches for hours, listening to their lives. And you know, here in LA, it's such a special place. I mean, Latinos permeate everything about LA. Our schools are close to 80% Latino. 40% of people here speak Spanish in their homes. Nearly 50% of those affected by police violence are Latino. It's really inexcusable that we have so many departments at the LA Times, critical departments like, you know, Campaign 2020, courts, police, crime investigations, Latin America, Washington, D.C., I could go on, that have either zero or only one Latino staffer. And though we do incredible work, especially in these last just couple of years, we've been doing really, really good work across the nation. Absolutely. I love everything that Francis just said. I mean, we're either, you know, holiday props, or they talk about our burritos and our, you know, plátanos. Well, not even about the plátanos, but you know, we're statistical, you know, figures. We're these kind of mysterious kind of shadows, you know, monolithic shadows in society when we're one out of five folks in the U.S. are Latino.
So, Esmeralda, one of the ways, the few ways that Latino journalists around the country convene is through the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Is it enough for us as Latino journalists? Is the organization enough for us to get this type of representation and everything else that we're looking for?
Wow, you know, that's a big question. It's an important question. I know that when, for example, when I look at the foundation of our paper, and I think this probably rings true for a number of other newspapers, it's really such a deep rooted issue. It goes beyond the hiring, promotion, retention, storytelling. It also goes to, you know, where are we advertising, you know, our newspaper's brand? What events are we holding in the community? What presence do we have in local high schools? What interns are we allowing in the room? And so the gathering of organizations like NHJ, you know, those conventions are very meaningful. I mean, that's how I got just about everything, you know, all of my connections and my roles at different papers that I played and have come from that networking that I've done at those conferences. But I feel like, you know, we absolutely have to have other channels so that we can support more of our young aspiring Latino journalists, so that we can talk about marketing research and what do Latinos, what can we do to have Latinos read newspapers and listen to, you know, mainstream radio and also television news. There's so many different places along the pipe where it's broken. And so there does have to be a far more, a 360 view, and that definitely takes a whole lot more than gathering once a year at a conference and having one organization. It's too much for just, you know, one organization to take on.
Graciela, we've been talking about mainstream English-speaking media so far, but Latino media in and of itself are also places that are rife with, obviously they're full of Latinos, but there are other issues that are happening there, namely in terms of the racial lack of diversity and in terms of the sexism that happens there. So how do we, where do those stand today? Places like,
yes,
Univision.
Right. So there was a social media outrage against some of the Spanish language TV coverage of the recent uprisings against police brutality. Many people were seeing anti-blackness and a very conservative coverage with a focus on the little destruction that was happening and not on the overwhelming peacefulness of the protests. So we are actually putting together a committee, and Francis is part of it, in a couple of weeks to create a document with recommendations for Spanish language media on how to cover race stories outside and within the community. So representation, as you said, is a big pending issue in Spanish language media, particularly if you look at the TV shows, Telemundo, Univision, and other local TV shows, you see very few brown and black faces on TV. I believe Ilia Calderon is the only Afro-Latina who is the anchor of a major news shows in the news show in this country. So we are also we are going to release in a couple of weeks content analysis we did. We've been analyzing more than 1 million news items from Spanish language media, trying to find the news agenda, trying to find what is the portrayal of women, what are the ways, the words. One thing we found is that also Spanish language media overwhelmingly covers immigration as a story. But in that case, I think it has to do with the fact that most 80% of Latino media in this country is Spanish language media. There's also, you know, English language and bilingual outlets, but the Spanish language media caters the immigrant community almost exclusively. There are very few content in Spanish language TV that is appealing to the younger bilingual, majority bilingual Latino population. And as you know, 2/3 of the Latino population are US born, are young, and are bilingual. So,
and that's been a challenge for a while for U.S.-based media to reach this sort of bilingual, younger Latino audience. But before we go, I want to make sure I ask Esmeralda one more question here, because Esmeralda, we have similar experiences in that as Latinas who are bilingual, I think, and as journalists of color, we're often asked to sit on diversity committees or be translators for our newsrooms. And I know a lot of Latinos who have experienced that. Sometimes that can be a good thing. It's gotten me some wonderful opportunities. Sometimes it can be a burden. How do you sort of navigate that space, Esmeralda?
I'm still trying to learn how to navigate that space, because I feel that, you know, while my primary job at the LA Times is to storytell and to spend time, you know, creating space for Latinos, I also, because I see, you know, this incredible absence at our paper, I feel this tremendous weight and pressure to, one, mentor, to be active in our local community colleges, high schools, talking to Latinos, to be creating some sort of a pipeline for Latinos to get hired at the paper, to be networking with different organizations, to create partnerships with our paper, because we need more Latinos. And so it's like, you know, when I talk to my editor, I'm always presenting this menu of like 5 different categories for which I have to do work for the LA Times today. 4 of those categories, I don't get paid for that work.
I was just going to say, I hope they're giving you a check for all the extra work.
Well, that's a whole nother story. But
well, you'll have to update us on what ends up happening after you all meet with the top brass there. Good luck. Esmeralda Bermudez is a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times. Francis Negron Muntaner is a professor at Columbia University. And Graciela Mochovsky is the executive director of the Center for Community Media at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism. All right, everyone, that's another week in the books for us here at The Takeaway. Amy Walter will be with you tomorrow, and I'll be back on Monday. Let's give a shout out to the people who make this show along with me. Our executive producer is Lee Hill. Our senior producer is Alexandra Boti. Jay Cowett is our editor. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Vince Fairchild directed the show this week. He was in the studio with our board operator, Debbie Daughtry. Jackie Martin was our line producer, and the segments were produced by Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Dina Syed Ahmed, Lydia McMullen Laird, and Katarina Barton. The incredible David Gable is our executive assistant. Thanks so much for spending your week with me. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.